they always ask businesses, what keeps you up at night? What's your biggest exposure that you see as a business? And cyber is always number one, if not top three, as part of that. So the fact that not everybody is buying it shows that we need to be doing something a little bit different. So they don't know how to transfer it effectively just yet. And I think part of that is because the insurance industry hasn't consistently articulated what cyber intends to do.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Lindsay Nelson, welcome to the Cyber Insurance Leaders Podcast. Really excited to have you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Glad we picked the hottest day of the year for this inside.
Boiling in a country with no air conditioning at all.
Yeah, England does not do well with heat waves.
Yeah, it's. I'm sure the train rails are probably melting and nobody can travel pretty shortly.
Yeah.
We'll sweat our way through this one and hopefully it'll be fun for everyone to watch. our discomfort will be entertaining for everyone else.
Yeah. I was saying earlier, if you see my hair start to blow back, it's only because I've turned my fan on and I'm not only hot, but I'm a bit faint. So I just thought it would look better.
All right. Well, let's jump into our discussion. But first, let's kind of talk a bit about yourself and the company you work for. What can you tell me? Let's maybe introduce yourself for the folks that don't know you.
Sure. So I'm Lindsay Nelson. I'm the cyber development leader at CFC. My background is actually more underwriting. So I was a cyber underwriter for over 10 years. Then I stepped into my current role as cyber development leader about a couple of years ago now, actually just before the pandemic, ironically. And it's a relatively new role in the industry that was really created because there was that obvious need for somebody to be responsible for strategic growth in cyber as a class of business. So today I oversee our global distribution strategy, our key broker partnerships, and really try to support the underwriters on those, form part of the cyber leadership team, which is involved in overseeing underwriting strategy. I would say increasingly over the last few months, especially a lot of internal development as well. So not just helping our broker partners, but creating underwriter training programs. We just launched our cyber masterclass program last week, which we're really excited about, really in order to solve the talent crunch of the market and really start to build an incredibly strong team from scratch. So that involves refining our messaging, making sure everyone's consistent across all of our cyber teams, making sure everybody feels confident enough with what we're going out into the market in. And like I said, making sure we've got the strongest team in the market. And I'm proud to say, I think we actually do.
Cool. So I did see that. I saw that you were launching a training course, and then at some point it's going to be opened up, you know, kind of to the market. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, so I guess you kind of told me about yourself, and what could you tell me maybe a bit about CFC and the team that you work with?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, CFC is a specialist insurance provider. I would say we're also a security provider at this stage as well. We were one of the very first companies to write a cyber policy back in 1999. We put together cyber insurance products really for companies from sole proprietors and more on the micro SME end, up into the large FTSE and Fortune 500 companies and everything in between, really. It was an incredibly long journey. When we first started, we were primarily distributing our product through telcos to commercial businesses. It was the only product CFC started writing. And then, of course, dot-com bubble burst. We had to expand to other product lines. But cyber is still very much a crucial part of what we do as a business. And after that 20-plus year journey of writing it, we really started to accelerate the last, I'd say, 6 to 7 years now. Mm-hmm. We're at the point we're approaching $1 billion gross written premium globally and from a standalone perspective. So we don't count our tech, you know, or extension figures as part of that. Team of almost 70 underwriters, 60,000 clients around the world. I sit normally in our headquarters in London and in the UK, but we've gone in the last few years from just having that one London office to offices around the world in Brisbane, New York, Austin, Texas, and Brussels, in addition to the London team. So about 700 staff around the world now. I was employee 150 when I joined 6 years ago. So tremendous growth in that time. I think the other key part of that is I mentioned that we don't just provide insurance products, but we're a cybersecurity company at the heart of the business as well. And to the best of my knowledge, as you know more than anybody, Anthony, we've got the largest cyber incident response team, the only active threat analysis team globally with over 100 people sitting around the world who really work day in and day out to stop cyber attacks for our policyholders. And then they're there to pick up the pieces if the worst happens at the end of the day. So, you know, I've heard many people call us, you know, in the market, the cyber market's first insurtech. I'm not totally sure that's accurate. I think every insurance company uses technology whatever degree that varies. But everybody uses technology for what they do at the insurance company level. So I always think the word insurtech is a bit of a buzzword and doesn't have too much substance behind it. But we do employ an incredibly large and growing team of software developers who are really responsible for our underwriter platforms, our external broker-facing platforms, our API integrations. And they work quite closely with our data analytics division, CFC Insight, who are there to make sure that we're using the data in the right way and the most meaningful way and taking advantage of our scalability in the market.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I didn't realize the premium had hit that kind of level. So that's a fantastic job growing the business. So in terms of geographies, then you mentioned a lot of different offices, and you know it's pretty interesting how you guys are all over the world now. You know, what are you really focused on in particular geographically?
I mean, we write cyber insurance in over 60 countries, but I would say in a meaningful way, our key focus is really Australia, Canada, US, New Zealand, Israel, UK, and Ireland. We're the largest writer of cyber in all of those countries, barring the US. I think we're top five now. But when I started at CFC in 2016, our portfolio was about 90% US and then 10% everything else. As of today, that's actually more of a 50-50 split, which I think actually feels quite unique in the market. You still see from a lot of our peers in the market a really incredibly heavy US focus, just given they were the early adopters of cyber insurance. And obviously, I want to take credit for anything built on the international side. But I think I'll humble myself a little bit. It's the reality is it's the markets outside of the US that have actually shown the fastest and best opportunity for growth. And we've really capitalized on how to trade efficiently in the US and then offer that everywhere else in the world. So it also tends to be the English speaking territories, as you can imagine, but that's more of a reflection of those markets, again, being the early adopters and us therefore being able to build that greater scale and write more confidently in them.
Yeah, wow, that's that is incredible that you've been able to take leading positions in so many of those markets. So yeah, pretty cool to see, definitely leading the way in terms of the international charge. I see a lot of people, a lot of companies pushing to do more and more of that. Obviously, the traditional insurers, you know, including some that you know really well, are kind of all over the place, but definitely seeing a lot of movement among the sort of the newer generation of MGAs and the insurtech word kind of pushing overseas, but they're just beginning to kind of come into the UK.
Yeah, I think we're quite uniquely positioned though in that way too, because you've got, you just touched on it with the traditional insurer piece. You've got your traditional insurers who have been writing in all of those countries, plus some way more than us for around the same amount of time. But you tend to get segregated units amongst those divisions where they haven't had the benefit of consolidating all of the data that they've got at their disposal into one unit and taking more of a global approach with it. The wordings look different in every country. Mm-hmm. The approaches might be somewhat different as well. And then on the other hand, you've got the new wave of insurtechs who don't have the experience or the number of years in the market, but they've got teams of data analysts and they've got the technology behind them. They're building quick scalability. So they've got the data and they're using it right in the right place. but they don't have the experience or scalability behind it. Like, you know, your traditional insurers, I'll keep names out of it, but
yeah,
I think CFCs sit somewhere in the middle of those two, and that we've had that scale, we've had the expertise, and, you know, to the earlier point of people considering us insurtech in certain ways, we've got the data and the technology behind us to really make use of that data, having been only in London for so long and really having that central access point.
Yeah, no, it's certainly an interesting position where you guys are sitting. So in terms of size of clients, then, you know, obviously traditionally you're well known as SME. Is that still the case? You know, what are you looking at in terms of size of clients you're focused on?
Yeah, I would say that's still true. Like I mentioned before, we want to write everything from the micro SME, those sole proprietors, up into the large risk managed clients within our corporate cyber division. And I would say, and we will write everything in between, although the everything in between has in a soft market been the most challenging to sell to, because it tended to come with a higher price point than an SME. And yet they didn't have the awareness that you get from a large corporate client to necessarily feel the purchase was valid for them or brought any value to them as a business. Now it also happens to be the same place where most of the claims are emanating from. So it's gone from that hard to sell to hard to buy for the mid-market space. So in terms of where we've really done well, it's been on the true SME space, which, like you mentioned, is probably what we're best known for. But certainly on the large corporate side, we participate in some of the largest towers globally in all the countries I mentioned before, and have a continued appetite to do so.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for that. I guess you've kind of said it already, but, you know, often I ask people, you know, what do you think your company's strength is in cyber?
Sure. A couple of other fairly different point, actually. On a similar note, on the SME side, I think what CFC have done really well historically, you know, by SME, I mean 100 million revenues or turnover and under. That's typically what we mean at CFC when we talk about SME business. But it's no coincidence that that's the segment of the market where the most work needs to be done in terms of converting the non-buyer. And so I'd say content and education, which is only made possible through the scalability and being able to pick out trends and different narratives from the claims data that we've accumulated, having written for so long, has been a big strength and a big reason why we are the largest writers in those territories I mentioned, is we've been able to do a lot of legwork behind not taking business off of our competitors or doing book rolls. It's building and converting, you know, the 85% of the market who aren't buying cyber policies into believers of cyber as a product. I think there's a lot of talk about transparency of data as well between that insurer broker client relationship. And I couldn't agree more with that philosophy, which is where I think education lumps into that. But I would say, in addition to that, proactive cyber services has probably been our more recent differentiator. So the ability for us to stop a claim before a client knows to file one. And I mentioned earlier, but we're one of, if not the only company, to the best of my knowledge, who are actively doing this around the world. And that's really using the combination of our threat analysis team, the threat intelligence feeds that we get into that team, combined with our data analytics division, who analyzes those feeds, and then our technology teams, who use that data analysis to then notify clients of their own potential compromises. And I genuinely think that every cyber insurer is going to have to implement this function into their business to continue keeping the product as broad as it is, and deal with that frequency issue of cyber claims.
Okay. So you have, it's kind of interesting. So I guess you have sort of a threat intelligence team, and then they're doing maybe what a traditional cybersecurity intelligence team is. And then you have maybe like a data analyst team kind of looking at some of those feeds and creating, like, using it to inform your models, or.
Yeah, exactly that. It's the evolution of the product, of going from, you know, years ago, we used to talk about it as an actual tangible product. Here's your policy wording, read through it, probably not until you have a claim, which is the most case, especially on the small business side. And, you know, we were trying to convert the market or get everybody on board with the philosophy that it's actually an instant response product. And it's the services around instant response, which you're very familiar with yourself. And now we're in that next stage of, yes, it's still a service, but it's not a reactive service. It should be a proactive one. And what can we do to actually stop claims before they happen? Because ultimately, that's going to benefit everybody in the market. Yeah. I had there was a broker I was speaking to in Canada, surprise, surprise, but a broker I was speaking to, and they had a really great anecdote around a client who had gone through a cyber claim with CFC. They felt really good about the way that the claim was handled. They had their financial compensation. They're back to that point of indemnification, back to up and running as a business operationally. But it still didn't get rid of the fact that they felt like they had been violated as a business, as in that intrusive feeling of somebody being in your networks. And so even though everything's been remediated, the fact that you went through it in the first place, whether there was any reputational harm or not, I think is that real differentiator between what cyber insurance is doing and what it could be doing in the future. And again, from, you know, when reinsurers and capacity providers are looking at what we're doing to stop claims or what other markets are doing to, you know, help solve the cyber issue in the market, that is exactly what companies should and can be doing if they use technology and data in the right way.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, well, cool. I guess, so we'll move on from that point. You know, I've been having different conversations with people. I hopefully been able to see some of the show so far. But one of the things a lot of folks are talking about is the hard market, sort of the rate increases and the difficulty in securing capacity. Just wanted to get, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's certainly a relevant question, a thoughtful one, actually, because if only because it's so rarely questioned as to whether it truly is a hard market or not. There's no question that the cyber market is in the most challenging time for clients and securing coverage. I absolutely agree with that. I can't imagine anybody would disagree. And they're dealing with prices that look very different today than they did 2 to 3 years ago. I do genuinely feel for brokers in this market. It's difficult for brokers in dealing with coverage potentially being halved for double the price, managing client expectations, the talent crunch that exists on the underwriting side with resourcing issues and trying to get a phone call back from somebody or any response is a frequently heard complaint from brokers. And for the underwriters who have always been equipped to sell more cyber, build scalability, they now have to pivot to manage their portfolios and sell to a much more defined type of client. And all of that is incredibly challenging for everybody when cyber as a product has gone from hard to sell to hard to buy. So based on those factors, everybody is now going around the market saying that we're in a hard market. There's a lot of comparisons in the market about comparisons to other product lines like D&O. So cyber is the new D&O. I really don't think it is. I think a hard market suggests that it's a cyclical market, as in rates went up because it was priced incorrectly, or insurers didn't know what they were doing, so eventually they'll go back down again. We've also just come out of the last 20 years of it being an incredibly competitive market with brokers advocating for the broadest coverage for their clients. We also see new entrants attempting to build that quick scalability, you know, in the last 3 to 4 years by writing new business incredibly aggressively. And from the coverage note, you know, it was only 6 or 7 years ago when retroactive dates existed as standard in cyber policies, and everyone thought we were crazy to remove them, but it's now market standard. Or you never used to see cybercrime or social engineering fraud on cyber policies years ago, and now theft of funds is the number one reason a lot of SME businesses actually buy a cyber policy. So I can think of very little today that cyber policies don't cover in the realm of intangible assets, because that's the coverage that clients have asked for, and that's what we want to provide them. So the reality is it's never been a hard market for cyber. It's not cyclical, or it's not that we didn't know what we were doing before. It's just that it's a market correction. And it's because the threat landscape has changed so drastically from the WannaCry, not Petya days of $300 per victim to now where it's targeted data exfiltration events as par for the course. Handling a ransomware event under $1 million is an incredibly good result when you factor in the systems BI, the forensic costs, the potential notification, the subsequent reputational harm, and that's without even talking about the demands themselves. So during the 2020 period, I remember, and that was the first year of market correction, there was actually a quarter where we saw 6 less ransomware claims by frequency than the same quarter in the year prior, but our clients incurred 10 times the cost, and that's only a function of demands going up, notifications arriving, a more extensive scope of forensic analysis as well to determine the root cause of the event. So, you know, as you mentioned rates. As for rates, the market isn't at a place as of today where we can confidently say that we can expect rates to go down anytime soon. But we are starting to see some positive outlooks. And I would say we can start to anticipate relief on rate momentum, as in they're not going to go down, but we're not expecting, assuming the threat landscape looks exactly the way it does today in 6 months' time, we're not expecting that continued rate momentum as in the same way that it has in the last couple of years. But it is a market correction. Okay. The whole market has learned a lot over the last few years. And so I don't think hard market is the appropriate concept for cyber as a product.
So you think the rates are kind of flattening a little bit? You know, that they'll hopefully stop kind of with the increase, you know, and then I guess just in terms of things that are being covered, you feel like that's relatively stable as well?
Depends who you're talking to. I think that's, you know, one of the more challenging parts of the industry is that there isn't consistency in approach to the hard market or market correction, I should say. So even I fall victim to it.
Market correction.
But removing coverage is an approach that some people have taken. You've seen the widespread event exclusions, everybody's favorite innovation this year. You've seen co-insurance provisions. You've seen a lot of markets exit cyber class of business full stop. Those tend to be the markets where their sole focus as an insurer was not cyber. It might have been 5% of their total premium. And the decision has to be, we're going to make significant investments in our incident response and our claims infrastructure, or we've got to exit because outsourcing isn't the issue as much today as it was in previous years. And then unanimously, I think we're all on board with getting the price right. But removing coverage is never the preferred destination that the market should go down, because it's the coverage, you need to continue to provide the coverage that clients are asking for. And we're in the business of providing a product that clients need rather than a product we want to sell as insurers. And we've always taken that philosophy with all of our product lines at CFC. It equally tends to result in insurers being negatively selected against, because then they tend to see the business or write the business because it's less likely to cover the most realistic claim. And that doesn't feel right at all for anybody, and certainly not why any of us are in the business of cyber insurance. And it's the same philosophy behind why we've never provided a micro SME product that removes incredibly important coverage to get to a certain price point. Mm-hmm. We would rather spend the time educating on the value of the product to justify the spend rather than diluting something we already spend a lot of time defending about how it works. And as we all know, it's arguably worked too well, given we know what the claims environments looked like. So, you know, getting the right, you know, we still need to make sure there's careful monitoring around that to make sure it's still an accessible product to most people. Yeah. But, you know, it does mean that we continue keeping the product as broad as it was in a period of correction, as it was in a soft market. And the wider picture, that means we're a more sustainable market.
Okay. Well, I guess I've seen, you know, other approaches to this. You know, people talk about these scans a lot. Like, here's how we're going to solve this problem. We're going to do a lot of scans. You know, I guess we sort of talked a little bit about it with your intel capability. But I mean, what are your thoughts on this? You know, from a technical point of view, this sort of proactive, okay, we're just going to scan everything and that'll, you know, sort of do it. What are your thoughts?
Are you ready for this one, Anthony?
I want to hear your opinion. We let's see if we argue over it. I don't know.
Fine. Okay. Outside in scans, I think they're one of the areas the cyber market I feel most passionately about. And you're right, we do have that capability at CFC. It is part of what we do within our CFC Insight team. What I strongly champion for is how we talk about the validity and accuracy of outside-in scans and how much weight we put into them being an accurate measure of a company's risk profile. I think outside-in scans require a lot more critical thinking today and their accuracy of determining that company's security posture than what's happening in the market right now. Especially when we consider 99% of a client's infrastructure is on the inside and what can't be captured from those outside-in scans. Mm. The alternative, of course, would be inside-out scans. But the challenge with those historically has been getting company buy-in to let a third party infiltrate their networks, get the full picture of their security maturity and their vulnerabilities. you know, the security skins, the way that they're positioned as well, they're nothing new. You know, they've been around for years. I think BitSight were one of the first people to ever do it over 10 years ago. But they showed up and the concept was really there to manage third-party vendors and test security credibility for larger organizations. Now they're being used, and we see a lot of our peers in the market using them to either determine what the underwriting decision should be up front before they get on risk, or more commonly being seeing them as being used particularly for SME business, where they're being shown as more of a sales and marketing tool to say, you've got an exposure. Here's a lot of fancy IT jargon and terminology based on your web address, which is attached to your external footprint as a business. And then if we can find this, then cyber criminal can as well. So it's a little bit of a scare tactic, I'd say, but that's what they're being used for today. But by the time they're read, they're already out of date, as they have incredibly low data refresh rates. And some clients saying they haven't captured critical network updates they've made for as long as hundreds of days. They tend to generate false positives that aren't relevant to the clients, and more so they tend not to have any predictive power to them either. So finding that information doesn't necessarily predict whether that client's going to have a claim or not. And I think we all know what those false positives are. A lot of clients see them as well. You know, we conduct those scans, but we can get a client to verify whether they're accurate or not rather than make the decision based on it. So, you know, I would say, from a sales perspective, more often than not, we're starting to see them become a barrier to selling cyber insurance, especially in a world where a client asks for further detail on it or doesn't understand certain IT jargon from it. You know, outside the cyber specialist teams, you tend to find at the global alpha house brokerages, most generalists don't have the capabilities without that specialism to explain much beyond that. So it actually can hinder the sale more than anything. So I do think there's a place for them in the market. I don't want to be all doom and gloom about them. You know, there is value to them. That's why they still exist. But threat intelligence feeds, proprietary claims data, you know, which can only be built up with time, experience and scalability in the market, those are still king when it comes to assessing a company's risk. And I think we should still absolutely be sure that we're being critical of the information in those reports and really only use it as a supplement to valid claims data and those threat intel feeds. That was the shortest way.
Okay. I don't want to. Yeah, it was you got me thinking about sort of claims data. You know, couldn't you just kind of show up, you know, sell a ton of policies and then get lots of claims data really quickly if you were going to throw tons of money at the problem?
Write a lot of cyber policies, build up that scalability quickly, just, get the claims coming out.
Yeah, within like 2 or 3 years, you know, as opposed to maybe 20 some years.
Yeah, you could do it. I'm sure a lot of people are doing that right now as well. It's, you know, but it's a very chicken and egg argument. Are you going to build up scalability at the price point that you know makes sense based on those reports? Or are you going to build it up based on your proprietary claims data because you've written it long enough to know what the right price is and should
make the adjustments? Yeah.
I don't think either is, you know, I'm not saying one is better than the other, but our experience has shown that the claims data has mattered. Yeah. It's just really consistent in that period of correction. And, you know, it feels right in terms of accuracy of data we're providing back to the client.
Right. Okay. Interesting. I think, it's something I think a lot about. That's why I just had to throw that question in there. I'm like, well, could you do it quickly? What would be the downsides of that? And I sort of like randomly go around in my head and I'm like, well, you could get a lot of it, but it would be hard and you would be taking a lot of risk.
And you would need to gain the support of providers sitting behind you who, in order to validate the decisions that you're making.
Well. That's exactly what I was thinking. It was basically, all right, you know, you're a big backer. You're like, well, we have a lot of extra money. You know, it's kind of like going to Vegas or something. You're like, well, I didn't really need that money. Maybe we could just gamble it a little bit. Yeah. But it could work. It could work. I think a lot about that. But cool. All right. Well, I guess kind of shifting to other challenges, you know, what are some of the other challenges you see in the market when it comes to selling the value of cyber insurance?
I would say, you know, overcomplicating a simple product, especially when we get to the smaller scale of client size. I think the way that cyber is explained to clients hasn't been perfected yet. I think it's almost a similar, it's a similar danger to having a claims professional become an underwriter. You know way too much, so you're going to overcomplicate it to the point of writing nothing. Some with security professionals as well, which underwriters increasingly are trying to become, whether that's right or wrong. The more you know, the more you have the tendency to overcomplicate what's actually a very basic concept. And I'll give a very anecdotal example of this. We did presentation training with our underwriters about this time last year. And you know, I asked the question, what is cyber insurance? As if I were the broker asking them back, and or a new client asking them back, which should be the easiest thing ever for anybody to answer, especially if you're sitting there as a cyber underwriter. But the amount of people who ran through every single insuring clause without stepping back to basics and just explaining as a philosophy what the product is meant to do. I don't think anybody ever really got to that elevator pitch or lift pitch in the UK, but elevator pitch, elevator pitch where you can say, you know, cyber insurance is X, Y, Z. I think as an industry, we should do a little better in just articulating what the product is intended to do. It's not intended to cover tangible assets like property. It's not intended to simply be a deductible infill or for BI or just cover the cloud computing provider outage. You should not be separating third and first party limits because structurally in the event of a claim, that doesn't make sense for clients, particularly where there's data exfiltration events. So it's not supposed to include or exclude widespread events either. It's supposed to be coverage for your intangible assets, full stop. And if you need another way to articulate that, cyber insurance could be a service-driven solution. It's access to a team of experts who will help you from falling victim to a cyber attack. But if you do, they're there to provide a coordinated response and pick up the pieces. And I think the way we get to that point needs to be simplified, especially on that smaller end of the spectrum. You know, you get a lot of those reports coming out. Brokers, insurers put them out. I think IBM does one every year. And they always ask businesses, what keeps you up at night? What's your biggest exposure that you see as a business? And cyber is always number one, if not top three, as part of that. So the fact that not everybody is buying it shows that we need to be doing something a little bit different. So they don't know how to transfer it effectively just yet. And I think part of that is because the insurance industry hasn't consistently articulated what cyber intends to do.
Okay. Yeah, that... it makes sense. It's an interesting point. You know, everybody knows cyber risk is a huge problem. Yet, you know, it's still such a battle to try to sell the value of insurance. I guess just in terms of, you know, outside of maybe the education piece or, you know, getting better at how you communicate it, how do you think we can make the overall market function better?
Yeah, I made an earlier point on this, but, you know, it's, I'd have to go back with being more transparent on data between insurers and brokers and clients. I think it's incredibly valuable. I think it's always really interesting for people to be a little bit more confident and therefore honest about their own capabilities to be able to pull back the curtain and show what's going on behind the scenes. So, you know, speaking to brokers about how underwriters are actually addressing risk, or why do we not ask questions here, but we ask questions on certain accounts. We get that question a lot for SME businesses where we only require the website address in order to quote. And yet for larger clients, you'll see a much lengthier application process. Brokers and clients want to understand why as a business, that is their route to getting a quote from us versus the other one. Or why are we asking questions full stop, explaining that application to brokers and clients as to why it's being asked. And I, you know, the number of calls I've been on with clients, whatever their function in the business is, you know, you can get that immediate sense of hostility as why is my insurer asking me to implement MFA? And they're totally correct. We shouldn't have to ask that, but unfortunately here we are. You know, any decision from an underwriting company makes that potentially blocks their premium growth and therefore revenue as a business is not taken lightly ever. It requires huge actuarial validation to get to that point. It requires underwriter buy-in. No underwriter in this market of correction or hard market likes being in the market because it involves a lot of difficult messaging to brokers. It's a lot less fun than it is being in a competitive and soft market and looking to build premium. So, you know, that underwriter buy-in requires, you know, what are we going to do to prevent this from happening? What can we do to stop this again? What do clients need to have to become insurable risks? We're all working to make sure that we can get those people the insurance that they need so that they can transfer that risk appropriately, because that's the product that we sell. And we wouldn't be in a very good position as a business if our revenue model was, not being able to provide the cyber products and clients aren't able to buy it anymore. So it's never questions on an application being asked just for the sake of asking them. Although I look at competitor forms and sometimes feel a bit different, but I think one of the solutions behind that is moving towards more qualitative answers on applications rather than the black, white, yes or no questions, just to tick a box, get more dialogue with larger clients. Obviously that doesn't work for volume heavy SME business, but certainly where the losses are happening, it tends to be more mid-market and large corporate. And those clients allow for discussions to be more qualitative and more of a narrative coming back with the underwriter.
It's interesting, and obviously there's limits, but especially as you get in larger clients, it's a lot like, when I was a security consultant, you walk in to a company and you kind of, there's a lot of narrative back and forth when you're trying to assess, what are their real needs? And obviously you have all these security frameworks, but it is amazing how just within an hour or two conversation, you could actually get a really good feel for how good somebody's security was just by what the things they talk about or, the things they talk about, the level of control they seem to have, the level of focus that the company seems to have on cybersecurity, all these kinds of different things. And it's interesting, you could walk out of it. And again, a lot of it was gut feel, but you could walk out of it with a pretty good gut feel, even though it wasn't just a long list of sort of questions you were going through. I think, back to your earlier point on data sharing, I think it's really interesting to see the kind of data that you can get with claims, because you can start to really pinpoint, all right, this is what's costing somebody a lot of money. And if we do, let's say us as a cybersecurity company or as an incident response company, if we do it this way instead of that way, maybe this way costs 10% more because we're doing, have extra people on it or whatever the case may be, extra time spent on automation. Yet the overall cost of the claim is like a third. Like the difference, it's interesting to have that whole view of what's going on, because you can kind of go, all right, there. But it's really hard to get that view. Even when you're in a claims team, I think it's hard to get that view sometimes. To never have enough time. But cool. Well, all right. Well, so what would you say then is the biggest challenge you see in insurance today?
Okay. I've got three. Can I go through?
Okay. Three? Let's do it. What are the three?
I think the biggest challenge for us is how we as an industry manage what is arguably one of, if not the most dynamic risk faced by businesses. So again, going back to what keeps businesses up at night, and every broker asks this, but very few underwriters do, I think. Most put cyber or their intangible assets in their top three. And that makes sense given the frequency of loss is so much greater for a company to click a malicious link rather than their building burning down. But I think another way of articulating that challenge is really how do we actually reduce the inherent volatility in cyber as a class of business? And as insurers, do we price it in a class where the historic results and claims and that data haven't been reliable indicators or predictors of future performance, because that threat landscape changes so quickly and so differently from year to year? How do we manage that to get to a consistent place in terms of what the price and managing the exposure looks like? And that's why we say things like MFA, having MFA doesn't mean you're not going to have a cyber claim. There's no silver bullet to stopping cyber risk or your cyber exposure. Is having that full on package, and insurance is part of that to help you stop that as well. So it leads a little bit into the second challenge, which is why I want to keep these together. Second challenge is the potential supply and demand crunch between customers wanting to purchase the product and the limited capacity available from insurers and reinsurers to supply it. So how do we actually attract the necessary capital into what is a rapidly growing class of business, given growth is continuing to outstrip the volume of capital able to support it? And that's really a combination of you know, growing underlying demand and increased capital requirements from regulators or rating agencies to the systemic element of the risk. So what happens when or if Amazon Web Services goes down? I'm reading a lot about Rogers in Canada at the moment.
The Canadian thing, yeah.
Arguably a monopoly on the country in terms of providing internet service, but was down for something like 18 hours or something ridiculous, something that would bother me.
Are you getting claims off of that, or is it excluded as critical infrastructure?
Critical infrastructure, it would likely fall into, but I think it's an interesting, it's not Rogers itself necessarily, as it is, it's going to trigger the dependent BI under Rogers policies, but very early days, I would say, to make any informed comment on that today.
Okay.
But,
interesting.
The last one in terms of challenges. So we've got, how do we price it correctly? How do we deal with the supply and demand crunch? The third one would be, how do we actually reduce the perception gap? And this is a bit of an ironic one, given we've talked so much about claims and exposures and businesses' biggest risk. But despite all of that noise and the rapid rise in claims volumes and growing losses for insurers, particularly at the SME level, they don't still appreciate the level of risk that they face. And many companies are surprised when they find out that cyber insurance is actually priced as one of their top three and sometimes top risk.
Yeah.
They underestimate the scale of the problem. So as a result, the penetration rates remain incredibly low. We think it's less than 15% of companies around the world actually buy a true standalone cyber policy. Mm. And you know, there's a long way to go to get that 85% up to speed.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, we're used to dealing with the markets that are more developed, as you talked about earlier, but kind of look at the whole world and you think, well, this is a huge risk for everyone. It's actually not that expensive to buy it, yet the penetration is still really low.
Yeah, I would say though, even, you know, the territories that we talked about before where we specialize in the English-speaking territories, Australia, Canada, US, even the US, you get numbers no higher than 35-40% in terms of market penetration. And that's for a product that's been sold since 1999 there. Mm-hmm. UK, Canada, Australia, I would say it's probably more accurate to say it's less than 10% are actually buying a cyber policy. And you can do some quick maths with that if you're talking about number of businesses that exist in the UK. We think the cyber market is X. We write this much over this many policyholders. You can get to a sort of a basic number, high level number quite quickly with that. But I think 15% would be quite generous for UK, Canada, Australia. And yet it's in the news every day.
Yeah. Interesting. I guess just kind of looking then, you know, kind of looking at what's happened with claims the last few years, what would you think the biggest difference to reduce loss ratios would be? What kind of thing can insurers do or can customers do? Like, what makes the biggest difference?
The price, Anthony. No, I'm just kidding.
Charge a lot more.
No, it is a good question. You know, this difference to reducing loss ratios, you know, the obvious one is actually just making sure that the price is right. And it does have a meaningful impact, of course, on what a ratio looks like. Yeah. Making sure that rate is appropriate definitely helps. Going back to my earlier point, cyber was the biggest exposure and the smallest and most competitively priced of their entire program for the last 20 years, which was never right. But I'll be a bit more original than that. I think, you know, covering off the basic minimum security requirements and security controls as a business, historically businesses have, when they have bought cyber insurance, as the applications have proven to us to be, they've transferred entirety of their risk over to insurance and failed to adopt even the most basic of measures. It's what Dan Truman calls the seatbelt moment, and making that analogy with auto insurers, you know, what was helping to actually reduce auto accidents was people actually having their seatbelts on. And it's the same thing with cyber insurance. Implement MFA and just the basic minimums, you know, MFA, endpoint protection, backups, we're all starting to become a lot more familiar with those from client and broker level. But the market tends to be fairly universal on what they look for in terms of just the basics. And we've unanimously called that action on to clients to just meet us partway rather than transfer that risk in its entirety. And, you know, back to that earlier point, again, we're asking it with cause and for a reason. We're not trying to create that barrier to entry with cyber. We want to keep the product as broad as possible. So, you know, just asking us to meet us halfway with that. I think the industry, we've done a pretty good job with that in that period of correction.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay. So minimum security standards, making sure the price is correct. Well, cool. Well, I guess just in terms of, you know, maybe what's your team or your company's biggest challenge then going forward?
In terms of what is different from what I named, you know, of the three challenges I mentioned, you know, the supply and demand crunch is definitely up there. We want to make sure that we're still offering the product that clients are asking for. But the perception gap is probably what we spend the most time and resources into investing. I said it was interesting when you asked about my role at the beginning in terms of that development role. That development role was January 2020. So it was in just before that period of correction in the market.
Yeah.
And it was just pandemic. So it was, you know, go out, travel, speak to as many brokers as possible, make sure our brokers are happy. We're giving them what their clients are asking for. Think of new innovations around that and build products around it. It pivoted really quickly as a combination of both the market correction and the pandemic. Obviously, I'm not jumping on planes anymore, or wasn't. I am definitely again. But, you know, it changes the type of education and content that you provide brokers and clients, and it changes the messaging completely. It's not, you know, it's a lot of here's why we're asking this, or here's why your pricing looks different, or let me help you as a broker manage that message to clients. Let me try to work with our teams internally at CFC and try to get their buy-in to give you the data that you're asking for and that your clients want to see to justify the decisions. I would say that's probably been the most challenging in the US, where, you know, there's a ton of competition, there's a ton of markets offering cyber, none of the least of which are trying to build aggressively and quite quickly. It's hard to be the market leader in changing that message. But I think, you know, we were fortunate enough to have a lot of markets all feel this exact same way about that correction period. But in countries like or territories like the UK, countries like Australia, Canada, Ireland, you know, where we have been market leaders, we're the first ones to make that step and actually say, this is what the market needs to do. This is what the price needs to look like. And you don't see your peers or competitors follow suit for some time until everyone absolutely has to. So I would say that was the biggest challenge, and still making sure as a result of all of that, and now that the world looks a little bit normal than it did before, making sure after 2 years of compound rate increases that we're still providing that accessible product and wrapping it around with the education, and making sure that our brokers are talking to clients about it in the way that we'd like them to, which is that proactive service-driven solution and selling cyber as a product that can stop a claim rather than just react to it.
Yeah. Okay. I guess we talked about this a bit earlier, but with the Rogers outage, but maybe what else do you find super interesting going on, like from a current events perspective in cyber?
I think I find it interesting that it's still ransomware we're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not ever going to get down to the very specific intricacies of every different type of variant and every type of attack, because I think we fall into the trap of it sounding too scare tactic for a lot of businesses. The fact that it's still ransomware happening, and you know, I think it's interesting that we're still taking a little bit of an approach of trying to get rid of it rather than manage and mitigate it, when I think that is the reality of it. And Dave and Graham did a podcast not too long ago, who you know I work with, but I liked their comment. They made a comment during one of them, which was, crime has been around as long as humans have in its existence. So crime is never going to go away. It's just crime has shifted from the physical to the electronic, and it's much more lucrative, much easier to conduct, which is why, and businesses are making it easier to conduct by, being vulnerable rather than valuable. That's the reason it still exists. It's not going to go away. Mm. Crime never will, but how we manage it and mitigate it is what we should be investing a lot of our resources in. So I think that's quite interesting. I think just the evolution of the product too. I think back, it must have been 2010 or 2011 when I wrote my first cyber policy, back in Canada, and it was still very much considered an E&O or PI liability driven product. You know, the electronic media and network security coverage, the first party expenses that now account for 96% of any cyber claim we see, were little $25,000 sublimits. By the time I got a cyber submission, and keeping in mind this is Canada, so smaller market, but by the time I got a cyber submission, I had to relearn how to underwrite again because it had been so few and far between from the last time somebody submitted a cyber submission. And now we're at the point where our team of almost 70 underwriters each see about 25, 30 a day, which I think is phenomenal in terms of the market development. So to go from that liability driven product to now we're actually working with government agencies and sitting on ransomware task forces and stopping claims before they happen so that you don't even need to trigger the wording, I think is incredibly interesting to in staying on top of all of that.
I guess you'd kind of, I guess, shifting a bit, but you'd mentioned it, sort of in the beginnings. How did you end up getting into insurance? I love this question because you get the craziest answers.
Sometimes people, it's usually either family or fell into it.
Right.
So I started in Toronto, Canada, where I was born and raised. I was in university. I was getting 2 degrees concurrently in psychology and education. So I was either going to go down the psychology route and get my PhD, which I didn't really fancy doing, or I was going to become a teacher, which was incredibly saturated in the Canadian market, i.e. no jobs. So while I was doing both of those degrees, I took up a part-time job because it wasn't enough as a bartender in a pub. And in perhaps the most stereotypical fashion ever, there were insurance people in that pub who became regulars of mine and convinced me to take up a temporary position as an executive assistant at a startup company at the time called WRB Canada, Berkeley Canada. I thought it sounded horrendously boring and I had to laugh because I listened to your podcast with Sarah Stevens last week. And she mentioned a similar reaction to being offered insurance. So I was like, yeah, me too. But ultimately ended up taking it. And I remember my very first week of insurance. I was explaining to my colleague, one of the casualty underwriters, when I was probably going to go bring him some paper files or something. I was planning to be a teacher. This role was only temporary. You won't get to know me very well. And he said, good luck. You're never going to leave insurance. And at the time, I was so offended by it. But 2 months later, I became the only cyber underwriter at the company just by way of putting up my hand. And nobody else knew the systems. So it was the most turnkey solution to finding a cyber underwriter in the market in 2010. And 12 years later, I've never been luckier for making that decision. Incredibly fortunate.
That's funny. Yeah, it's like you said, by accident. I think it's by accident for anyone that's not related to an insurance person. I do love it. But isn't that the best thing about London, though? I love the generational insurance people. It's I'm fifth generation insurance. What?
Yeah. But they're probably, the ones, in interviews, if I've ever interviewed in the past, I always ask them that question as well, just to get any interesting answer out of there. But it's always the people who had family and insurance who were more reluctant to get into it. You just want to, create your own path and do your own thing. But then you are brought to the dark side slowly and surely. And it's interesting. It's such an innovative industry. I mean, going back to the talent crunch, it's so much more work we can do in terms of getting into universities and colleges and, high school or equivalent of in the UK to actually advocate for it. Because had I known that, I would have saved my mom a lot of time and money of paying for 2 degrees insurance. And in respect, I wish I had done something a little bit more around insurance. I'm so grateful for the experience I got, but, there's definitely a lot of work that we can do to advocate that it exists and it's not just crunching behind your computer.
It's funny when you run into people who, there are actually individuals who have an insurance degree, believe it or not, but they're so rare. Wait, you actually went to school for that?
Yeah. I mean, if you Google, there's a website called willarobottakemyjob.com or something like that. I think that you'll get the same result. But if you type in underwriter, it says, in 5 or 10 years, I can't remember the metric offhand, but it says in 10 years, a robot's going to take your job as an underwriter. And a lot of underwriters sitting there will listen to that and not be particularly happy about it. But the reality is there are systems and technology that can do a lot of that. And what that ultimately does is free up the underwriter's time to work on larger and more complex risks, get to know the client, get to do the travel, the networking, you know, all the stuff that people consider the fun bits.
Yeah.
Get to become security professionals on the side. It frees up time for that. So you get to expand your education. You learn about so many different businesses. I'm quite passionate about more people getting into insurance at an earlier age than I did.
I think if people understood the nature of insurance as being so people oriented and the reasons why, I think tech people, you know, especially introverted tech people, look at insurance and they're like, I could just automate all this. I don't even understand why there needs to be a person in the middle. And it's like, well, because you're buying an intangible product in many cases. So like you need to have the trust and the personal relationship to know that what you're being sold is what you think you're being sold.
Agreed.
At least that's my opinion on it. I think it's always going to be a people business no matter what.
It always will be a people business. It's people that are there to supplement and make the best of the technology and the efficiencies. And the technology there is for operational efficiency.
Yeah.
Take off the volume business that can be done through that. And, you know, it's symptomatic of SME business and underwriting that we're never going to get to know every single one of our 60,000 policyholders, despite us wanting to.
Yeah.
But what we are doing as underwriters for volume business is picking out trends and patterns and coming to conclusions based on that. Whereas obviously on the large risk managed side, you're looking at each individual account quite specifically and for its own merit.
Mm. Yeah. So I guess, coming down to the end of our questions, I think you and I could probably go for another hour on some of these topics. But who do you think should be our next podcast guest and why?
I'm going to pick two.
Okay.
Because I'm clearly indecisive about this. I would definitely pick Dan Truman.
Okay.
He wants to hear that or not, but he's very much, I would consider, the godfather of cyber insurance next to Graham Newman, but I won't pick CFC to get rid of some of that bias. He's the one that talks about that seatbelt moment. He's got great insights on product evolution and the market. So definitely him. But second, I would say Tom Bennett, who I think you know quite well.
Yeah, I'd love to have Tom.
But
CFC bias, but of course, I think he'd be amazing.
Not on the underwriting side, though. So, Tom Bennett leads our cyber threat analysis team. And you know him well, of course, but I think 10 minutes with Tom is equivalent to a lifetime of expertise in terms of threat. And anytime I know I have a conference or a meeting, I always speak with him first to get the latest and greatest on trends. And
yeah,
I think he doesn't appreciate how much he knows. And we'll just talk and you're like, wow, that's a great story. That's a great narrative. But his team are doing some really cool things with being able to spot cyber compromises, notify policyholders. And he's got some real success stories I think your audience should hear about. And probably some scary ones too for lessons learned, because those tend to be the fun ones to hear as well.
Yeah, I've been meaning to chase him down. He's always on a road trip with you. So it's a tricky one. But it'd be great to have either one of those guests. I think they'd both be great. Last question. You can directly address our audience. Is there anything anyone in our audience could help you with?
Yes. There's a thing that we do during performance reviews called stop, start, continue. I'm sure we're not the only ones, but something that can be that I would ask to stop doing in the market if I'm speaking to an audience. I would ask our broker partners to stop placing emphasis or asking for wording comparisons. I think they do more harm than good. Yeah. An insurer is always going to have a level of bias to it. It should never be an insurer who provides you with a wording comparison. And I think it takes away actually from the focus of what you're actually selling, which is a service, not an insuring clause and access to experts. I would ask to start asking cyber insurers and us at CFC, I would ask us how many claims we've stopped rather than how many claims we've handled. Uh-huh. We always get that question, how many claims have you handled? And we've got a big number attached to that as well. But I think it's a much more valuable question for your clients if they hear, how many claims have you stopped? Tom and his team, the last time I asked him, it's something since the inception of his team, it's something like 12,000 clients that they've actually notified in terms of vulnerabilities and compromises to their networks, which I think is such an incredible story. And it's cyber policy working for them from the very first day that they bind it. And it's the only product line where we can provide a product where we don't just have to bind it and sit and cross our fingers and hope that a claim doesn't come through. We can actually think about that proactively. And continue, please, asking us questions and asking for feedback and giving us, letting us know where we can help, which I know sounds very superficial and corporate, but I genuinely mean that. What, you know, we want to be able to create something valuable back for you to sell and what your clients are asking for. And that only happens if we keep that dialogue going. So I would plead to continue doing what you're doing in terms of that, because we genuinely appreciate it.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for that. I know I said it was the last question, but bonus question. Where can people get in touch with you? What's the best way to get in touch with you? How can they find you?
I think Graham Newman always makes fun of me for how much I engage with the market on LinkedIn. So I'll probably just own that and say that's the best route. Lindsay Nelson at CFC. Okay. Send me an email, lnelson@cfcunderwriting.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Lindsay. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here. Enjoy chatting with you. And I do owe you, I think, a margarita, you said, coming on the show. but cool. No pressure. All right. Well, cool. Well, let's definitely talk again soon. It's a pleasure having you, and thanks a lot for coming.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks.
If you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Acerius, visit acerius.com. acerius.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.